history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not remain untold. But they will, unless we take the time to ask a few questions and then listen patiently and attentively to what some of our most experienced Americans have to say. The goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom, and in the process, it's amazing what we end up learning. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we end up inspired by what we have the privilege of hearing here on Hometown Heroes. One of the things I haven't done the best job of is keeping you updated when significant things happen in the lives of veterans after they've shared their stories on the radio with us, but I do have the chance to do that today, and it's a reminder that even in times as bleak and trying as the last few months have been for America and for the world, we can always find silver linings if we're looking for them. For many of us, the COVID-19 era has resulted in a slower pace or an opportunity to catch up on or complete projects we always said, if I ever get enough time, I'll finish this or that. When you're an award-winning filmmaker who all of a sudden has to hit the brakes on new shoots, you get to go back and finish that labor of love you started years ago. And that's what Cameron Mitchell experienced in completing the documentary Flight Path to NASA, A Pilot's Journey. It tells the story of legendary test pilot Don Malik, whose many contributions included a very significant contribution to the eventual landing on the moon. When Don shared his story on Hometown Heroes in 2018, we learned that the service of his father and uncle in World War I and his older brother's time as a bomber pilot in World War II inspired his own quest to become a Navy fighter pilot and then a true pioneer as someone willing to fly aircraft that had never been flown before. At hometownheroesradio.com, you can link to that original interview and also to the trailer for the new documentary. I think you'll really be intrigued by watching it. And here on the radio, I can at least let you listen to it before we catch up with Mr. Malik and Cameron Mitchell, the man who has captured his story on film. Here's part of that trailer with portions of it shot on location at Edwards Air Force Base in California's Mojave Desert.
This is the home of test pilot school. This is the home of flight test for the entire nation and much of the Western world.
NASA benefits tremendously from our test pilot and research pilots. The skill set they bring to the table is another set of eyes and ears from their perspective. As much as you want to plan and design a test and a research program, it's not until you actually get in the plane and fly it that you have that real feedback.
Then there are the experimental aircraft that nobody else has, and that requires pilots who are able to make the adjustment to something that has never flown before, that no one has ever flown before, and for which you can only create a simulator on the assumption of certain flight parameters. So let's take Don Malik, for instance.
In Don Malik's case, he has flown more aircraft than most of us could probably even name. And having the skill set to adapt from one plane to the next, sometimes within the same week, is very difficult to do.
I had a little over 11,000 hours flying and 125 different types of helicopters and airplanes combined.
To become a test pilot, you have to compete. So you're competing against the best there is. I'm trying not to be a smart aleck. How do you know there's a test pilot in a room? He'll tell you.
The work that Don Malik did and the rest of the team on the lunar landing research vehicle was critical to the Apollo landing.
They flew a machine that had never flown before. They flew it, a machine that nobody really thought could fly. It was ungainly, it was awkward, it was bizarre.
The first flight, Neil Armstrong not only ran out of thrusting propellant, but he ran out of attitude propellant, and the vehicle went out of control.
He had to eject, and the parachute opened up just in time for him to touch the ground and survive. He went back to his office and went to work. A little while later, one of his colleagues walked through the office and saw him and said, "Hey, Neil, I just heard the funniest story. I heard you ejected from the LLRV about an hour ago." And Neil said, "Yeah, sure." And he just couldn't believe that he just got back up and went to work.
From the time I was 12, I always wanted to fly. Flying and being a contributor to the lunar mission meant everything to me.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Okay, Houston, as I stand out here in the wonders of the unknown at Hadley, I try to realize there's a fundamental truth to our nature. Man must explore.
Risk is the price of progress. That is the history of the experimental rocket program here at Dryden.
Roger, understand. We're number one on the runway.
Two roads diverged in a woods, and I took one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference.
Again, that's the trailer for the just-completed documentary, Flight Path to NASA, A Pilot's Journey. And on the line now, we have both the subject of the film, 89-year-old Don Malik of Lancaster, California, as well as the filmmaker, Emmy Award winner Cameron Mitchell. They first met many years ago when Cameron accompanied the late, great Huell Howser to Edwards to shoot an episode of the esteemed TV series California's Gold. It focused on the LLRV, the Lunar Lander Research Vehicle, and its irreplaceable role in the development of the lunar excursion module that Neil Armstrong would land on the surface of the moon in 1969. Cameron was so struck by Don Malik and his life story that he decided someday he would try to capture that story in film.
Well, the first phase, you know, we kind of were moving along slowly, and we had created together the documentary short called Risk is the Price of Progress, the story of the LLRV. And that was entered in a number of film festivals around the state and different places, and garnered some accolades. So that was kind of the ground floor to moving on to a flight path to NASA, A Pilot's Journey. So it's been a long trip, and Don stuck by me through the whole process. And he was constantly referring me to different people to interview, and the folks at NASA have been super fantastic over there. But so that was the start of it, the documentary short, and I had always wanted to do a full-length feature on Don, kind of giving the whole encapsulation of Don's life from his beginnings in aviation and all the way up to the grand finale.
I think an important part of it, too, was, Cameron, where you were able to include a number of the other NASA people that were involved in a lot of those developments and everything. I was just one call going to gear that did a lot of that work, and I think when you integrated the others in together, it really made a strong story.
What was it about Don? Because, you know, working with Huell Howser, who we all remember so well, and I'm glad, you know, Don forgave him for being a Marine, but working with him, I'm sure you met a lot of interesting people in a lot of places. So what was it about Don and his story and his life that grabbed you the way it did?
Oh, my goodness, there was so many. I found out that he came from a multi-generational military family. His father and one of his uncles served, and his brother was a bomber pilot in World War II, who was a decorated pilot. And then ever since Don was a little boy growing up in Pennsylvania, Don kind of got the idea in his head he wanted to be a pilot, too. So we followed this story, you know, all the way from his childhood, and I think just all the amazing accomplishments Don made with the XB-70, the M2F1, the lifting body plane, the Blackbird SR-1, and the YF-12, I think it was Don. And it just had such an amazing history to his flying days with NASA. I said, this guy's story's got to be told. I mean, he's the guy behind the curtain that you never hear about, but he contributed to one of the most major accomplishments in NASA history by developing and working with the LLRV to get the guys to the moon.
Well, you just kind of hit on it. There are so many people that get attention, and most of the general public knows bits and pieces. You know, they can tell you that Neil Armstrong was the first on the moon, and they can tell you maybe the other astronauts on that mission. Most of them haven't heard of the LLRV. And most of them never think of things in terms of test pilots and everything that they risk and everything that they have to master. For people who get the chance to watch this documentary, what are the important things that you hope they learn from the story you're trying to tell?
I'd say the biggest thing is that it takes a very, very special, unique individual to commit their life to the aviation and to this, you know, type of career, because you have to have, Don can tell you, you know, strong engineering background. And, you know, a lot of the pilots do come from, you know, military backgrounds. And it's just that real tenacity of boldness and intelligence and just a love of flight and their willingness to, you know, go out there and say, okay, this plane or this strange vehicle, like the Lunar Land Research Vehicle, has never been tested before, but I'm going to get in this thing and use my wits and my experience to learn how to fly this and, you know, contribute to aviation and moving these types of projects forward. I'm sure Don could tell you a couple exciting stories about the LLRV and some of his first flights.
You know, and Don, I ran into a guy the other day, was introduced to someone, and he's one of those. I know there are a few of them out there who hold to this belief that the lunar landing was somehow staged, that it didn't really happen. And I said, well, you know, I've met a few people who were part of it, including a guy who had to not only test the lunar lander research vehicle, but he had to put it together like something you order from IKEA or Home Depot. And I was just picturing you taking these PVC pipes and different fittings and everything and you know, with your team there constructing this LLRV. I know it's been more than 50 years. It's a long time ago. But do you ever look back on that and say, what were we thinking? Why did we think something like this was going to help take us to the moon?
Well, it's interesting. The idea of the Lunar Lander Training Vehicle or Research Vehicle, I think, generated back at NASA Langley, where the idea came up, where they needed something, some good training device, not only to help the astronauts basically with training, but to determine what the control powers were going to be required to land in a different environment, because every pound of fuel they carried to the moon, it took, you know, so many thousand pounds of fuel to get them off the Earth. It was a critical thing. So they needed a couple of things. They needed to figure out what was required to really land safely on the moon, and then following that, they needed something to train and expose the astronauts to it before they get up there for the first time. So when they decided to build it, have one constructed by Bell, it was decided it would be flown out at Edwards. And I think the reason was it was Edwards that worked with some of the different rocket fuels and specialty items and things. And they had the great test area. So when they had it built, apparently the contractor was asking for additional money to do the early flights on it, flight development on the vehicle. And NASA was, even though they had a space budget, they were still short in certain areas. We said, no, ship it out here. We'll put it together and we'll fly it out here. So that was what happened. It come out in parts and pieces. I personally didn't bolt anything to it. I just observed and watched as our fine team of mechanics and engineers put it all together, and there were several test rigs that were built where we were able to put this up on a pedestal, pivoting pedestal, to evaluate the rocket control systems in it and some of the other things even before we flew it. So it was an interesting progress, and it was nice from the piloting standpoint that we were the first ones to do it and to have to do it, and it was built in-house, and it was monitored in-house and flown in-house. So from that standpoint, it was a real fine project.
You know, and I think just here in recent months, we've seen, you know, a U.S.-built rocket take off, head into space, and deliver the astronauts to the International Space Station to much hubbub and attention and celebration. When you watch that, and you see the technology that NASA is working with today, can you give us a comparison or a contrast to how different that is from what you were working with in the 1960s?
Well, a little bit. I followed that launch very closely. I had those boys in my thoughts and prayers because that was the first real civilian effort, even though it was government money, NASA money. Element. That was a private company that did all that. And for years, there had been pressure for NASA to move some of this contracting and space work to the private companies. And I don't argue with that. I think that's fine if they're able to do it and they have the level of safety and the monitoring and everything. And so I was real pleased when they made that mission where they were up and got their rendezvous and hooked up with the space station. I know they've made a lot of advances in engineering and technology and automation, and I wonder in the back of my mind, we're going back to the moon hopefully by 2024, but I'm wondering myself now if they're going to really try that completely automatic or if they're going to have the astronauts involved as we did back in the days of the LEM when they first landed on the moon. And although the computers and everything that we had on our initial moon program were pretty weak compared to what's available today. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if they don't go completely auto land up there when they go back. But time will tell on that. But I'll keep an eye on that. But I know they've made a lot of advances in computers. We thought we had it all in our day, and we look back and think we had hardly nothing compared to what they're working with today.
Which makes those accomplishments all the more impressive, given what you were working with.
Well, that's right. I think it's like a pyramid or a ladder. One is built upon the other, one step after the other. And further down the road, they'll look back at what's going on today and say, oh, that was old hat. That's old stuff.
Don made a really good point in the documentary when we were talking about the future of NASA and space, like, you know, possibly, you know, back to the moon and to Mars. And in the documentary, the question was put to Don about, you know, how much did he feel he contributed, you know, with his work with the LLRV. And that technology was going to kind of help advance, hopefully, you know, to go to the moon again, which you just talked about, and then be would kind of work from that basis to a newer type of, obviously, you know, 50, 70 years later, to a newer type of vehicle to similar sort of thing.
It's all building blocks. That's right. What comes today is built on what happened yesterday, and what will come tomorrow is what we build on what we do today. So it's just an evolution. And it's, sometimes it's pretty damn impressive what's going on in technology.
If there's somebody who's flying, you know, even one of the classified aircraft that none of us know about right now, that's the top of technology. For somebody like that who's used to the best that's out there right now, do you think they would have some challenges trying to saddle into that LLRV and figure out how it works?
There are always going to be challenges. I don't think they would have any question on what existed with the LLRV and what happened with the LLRV. And I don't think we even duplicate it, but they'll build beyond it. You know, if they go to the moon again and it's an automatic landing, they may not even have the capability of a manual landing. I'm not sure what they'll be planning on it. If they're planning on having the astronauts still have that capability, then they're going to need something to replace the LLRV or to be in its, you know, the same type of a motor training. So that'll all determine what the big planners come up with for the mission. Now they're sending things off to Mars in the next couple of months, I guess, from several countries where they're going to land on Mars, and they're going to supposedly retrieve samples and stuff like this, and that's all going to be automatic. So they won't need any LLRV training for that. They'll just need technology to do it automatically.
And I know you and I talked about this before, but what were the biggest challenges for you doing something that no one had ever done before? How much of it was just trying to get a feel for how that would behave, the conditions that those astronauts would be facing, and what the pitfalls they might encounter were? How big a piece to the puzzle was that?
I think the operating or flying the LLRV in that simulation environment, which it could do pretty well. It had a pretty fair simulation of the lunar gravity and no atmosphere and everything. I think that was real important as far as the past missions up there.
You know, since a few things have happened here, we had the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. There was also the film that came out focusing on Neil Armstrong, first man. In all of that, in the publicity around the 50th anniversary and the film and the different things that were said and done, did any of that have an impact on you, how you viewed that overall accomplishment of everyone who worked on it, including your contribution?
It did, on the anniversary of recognition of it and looking back. But as you noted, there was a tremendous pyramid built up under that final landing on the moon with a lot of people involved. And I'm sure that everyone that was working in that era on part of that program and that responsibility had a feeling at the 50th anniversary. They looked back and they thought, well, we did all right. We did it. And I had that feeling, and I was proud to remember it and happy to remember those days. It's something that I think probably big in a lot of our people's history that were involved with it directly.
It's break time, but there's much more to come with test pilot Don Malik and Cameron Mitchell, the filmmaker who has captured Don's story in a new documentary. Flight Path to NASA is what it's called. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page to watch the trailer for the film or link to more information about the project. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.